I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Dateline, Concord, Massachusetts. Oscar season 2020. We're listening for Olcott family footsteps in their orchard house on Lexington Road. What I'm hearing is that the writer of Little Women understated her own case. Real Louisa May Olcott had been an abolitionist from the age of three, a boyish girl who didn't just long to see the horror and heartbreak of the Civil War. She was the one, not her father, who went to the front near Washington and held the hands of dying soldiers. In the creative classroom back home, the Olcott sisters' play space today is full of their costumes and props, swords and boots for their theatrical charades. Also on the bookshelves, the classic novels of George Eliot and the Bronte sisters, where the girls really did define themselves by reading. Their drawings on the doorframes are intact. Oil paintings on the walls remind you of baby sister May's ambition to be a great painter. John Ruskin, the ultimate critic, judged that she made it. The god of Louisa May Alcott's life, disguised in the movie, was the great sage across and down the road, Ralph Waldo Emerson. She got warmer respect from Emerson than her dreamy, ineffectual father did. This was the real woman that the movie maker Greta Gerwig could feel, still running through that Olcott family space. The curator, Jan Turnquist, walked us through it this week.
When I watched the movie for the first time, I was overwhelmed with the sense that Greta Gerwig had made this movie as a love letter to Louisa May Olcott. Now, Louisa was ready to take the world on, and she has a lot of that in her character, Joe. But her publisher, just as you see in the movie, you see the publisher saying, now she has to marry. My goodness, you know. Yeah. Make sure she's married or dead by the end. Either way. Louisa didn't agree with that. She wanted Joe March to pave that way, show young women that they have other options. But she made the compromise because she was a pragmatist. She wanted the book to sell. So she said, all right, I'll make a funny match for my Joe. And she had the last laugh because everything about Professor Bear was a little bit unusual.
In short, the author is a more determined rebel than her character.
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly. I agree with that.
You say she was a feminist, clearly. I hear she was also an Emersonian. That whole business of trust thyself, speak your mind, every man and young woman must be a nonconformist. Whoso would be a real person must be a nonconformist. Don't worry about consistency. All of these aphorisms from Self-Reliance, she lives them.
Yes. Louisa adored him. And in this room, in the parlor, when her older sister, Anna, married John Pratt, that took place in this parlor. Emerson was here. He kissed the bride. Louisa said it would almost be worth it to consider matrimony if it would mean I could have a kiss from Mr. Emerson. She said he was the god of her idolatry. And you are correct. Everything that came out of his mouth or from his pen was gold to Louisa May Olcott. She wrote to him. She wrote love poems in the middle of the night, sitting up in a tree when she was about 16 or so. Later, she told him this, you know, when they were just in a different place in their lives. And he said, well, where are my poems then? I never got them. And she says, oh, I burnt them up.
She would have been closer to Thoreau's age. What was that connection?
She adored Thoreau as well. He was like an older brother to this band of girls and their friends. He took them on walks around Walden. He took them berry picking.
Emerson children adored him. I mean,
he was always pranks, acts.
Yes.
And the Olcott children adored him too. And I think most of the children in town adored him. He was just, he was made for the delightful spirit of a child. He never lost that spirit. I think that Mrs. Olcott should be given an enormous amount of credit for how she helped those young people develop creativity and joy, because they were struggling financially, But a lot of the time they didn't feel poor because they were getting ready for a play and they were in the rag bag and they found wonderful fabric. A lot of their relatives who were well off gave them hand-me-downs so they could have decent clothes, they could have wonderful scraps, they could make costumes, props, invite all their friends in. And if you are inviting half the neighborhood in to see a production that you have spent months on and you've made elaborate props and costumes and scenery. And they did. People have said to me two things that I love when I hear either one of these. Some people will say, walking through this house is like walking through the book Little Women. And the other thing that people will say sometimes is, it feels like the Olcotts might walk in any minute.
I was going to say, cue the girls.
Exactly.
Interesting difference that Joe in the book and the movie says, I should be out there fighting, doing something active as my father is. But in real life, she went.
Yes. She would have even loved to have gone on the battlefield, but the only way women fought side by side in battle was if they fooled everyone and pretended to be a man. Right. She wasn't the kind of person who would do that. But being a nurse was already quite daring, and it put her right in the middle of things. And she said, the May blood is up.
Wow.
when the call went out for soldiers. And of course, she stood in the center of Concord, as everyone did, to see these first soldiers go off to answer Mr. Lincoln's call. And she said something like, a small town is like a large family in times like these.
In real life, it's Louisa that goes off to war. That's a very major point.
Yes. And another point that is maybe a more minor point, but I think it's significant, is that Louisa loved to run. She said at one point, I must have been a deer or a horse in some former existence because it's such a joy to run. That's what Louisa was doing, leaping over fences, climbing in trees and falling out of them. She loved to play with the boys, and the boys didn't want to play with her because she was a girl. But she would accept a dare. Oh, I dare you to jump off the highest loft of Farmer so-and-so's barn. She'd do it. One time she did it, sprained both ankles, had to come home in a wheelbarrow. So she was doing these things that were physical. She was a very physical girl. In that era, people would say, that is, first of all, not ladylike. We women do not do those things. And secondly, it's probably ruining your health.
What are the earmarks of the Olcotts in this house, even in the wallpaper and the furniture?
Well, one thing that's fabulous in this house is that all over you see May Olcott's original art. In every single room, these paintings are hers. These particular ones, these are copies of Joseph Turner. She was hired by a London art museum to copy their Turners because many people said they had never seen such excellence in the ability to copy Turner. But also over here, you see the flower panel. You saw paintings on the wall in Louisa's room. When you go into May's bedchamber, you see she drew on the walls. I mean, it just everywhere there's evidence of the creativity, the spirit of that sort of...
The painter who says she's going to be great or nothing.
That's right. That's right. Yes, yeah. She. And again, look at the parents who somehow transmitted that sense to all of their daughters, really. You can do what you want to do. Don't listen.
I didn't know about the Turner. You can do what Turner did.
Yeah, exactly.
What Turner does.
Don't hold back. You go for it. Now, Beth died too soon and was very shy, although she did love music exactly as you see Beth in Little Women. And Anna, as Meg, had very different ambitions. And Anna felt very much the way you see the scene between Meg and Joe in the movie, where Joe says, come on, we can run away. I can support us. Let's go. And Meg is saying, I love him. I want to marry him. I want a family. And what I love about Louisa is, and it's true of this family on many levels, they are inclusive. You do not have to do what Joe March wants to do to be a fulfilled and wonderful person, to be admirable. But at one point, Louisa did say, I've married my pen. Books, therefore, are my children. Anna married a human. Her children love us, but my children feed us.
How would Louisa have defined that very elusive word, transcendentalism. What sort of a transcendentalist are you, Louisa?
Well, first of all, I can't resist telling you that when they were doing many of their different dramatics, one of the things they loved to do was charades. But they did charades not like today, where it's just somehow spontaneous. They would plan it out. They would have costumes, and it was like a mini, mini play. So one time, she was doing a charade for a group of people, her father amongst them. And the first scene, she had her friends, and she had like a turban on or something, and she was in a
trance.
Yes. The next scene was from a play that everyone knew at that time, in a famous scene of Send for the Doctor.
Oh, my word. I can hear it coming.
Yes, you can. The last scene, she comes back, and she's got a big lump here.
Flossing or something.
Dental. So, Bronson loved it. Bronson just thought it was hilarious. How she would describe it, I don't know that I ever heard her actually describe it, but I've heard many people say, if you put 10 ardent transcendentalists in a room together, you would get 10 different definitions
right.
of transcendentalism. But there would be common ground in the sense that you believe that something goes beyond or transcends your daily life, your daily thought. There's something ineffable that is here amongst us. And you will find it through nature. And she said, as she saw the sun come up and in between some pine trees, and there was no sound except the wind and the trees, she said she felt the presence of God in a way that she never had before, and it never left her. She said it has stayed with her, that feeling, in 40 years of life's vicissitudes. So that, to me, is a transcendent experience. She understood transcendentalism more than she would have said. Let's lecture about it. That was not her thing. But she understood it. Viscerally, she understood it.
That was Jan Turnquist, executive director of Orchard House, the Olcott home in Concord, Massachusetts. Coming up, what Greta Gerwig says she learned in Concord about artists, herself included, turning lives into art. This is Open Source. Greta Gerwig told a lot of her own backstory in Lady Bird, her breakthrough film 3 years ago. She was the kid from a no-TV home in a convent high school, determined to be a dancer, actress, writer, and get herself out of no-account Sacramento, California, to the big time, back east. And so she did, a philosophy major at Barnard College, next to Columbia in Manhattan. She took on the umpteenth movie production of Little Women as her own passion project, with big ideas getting tested in every scene of the old young adult classic. Here is the Irish actress Saoirse Ronan playing the part of Jo March in the movie, confronting the Victorian expectations of women.
I just feel like women, they have minds and they have souls as well as just hearts, and they've got ambition and they've got talent as well as just beauty. And I'm so sick of people saying that love is just all a woman is fit for. I'm so sick of it. But I'm so lonely.
Greta Gerwig is sworn to the ideal of art that makes life, makes importance. My question was, how did Little Women become her life?
Well, Little Women was the book of my youth. It was the book that made me want to be a writer. And Jo March was my favorite character. And I not only read the book once, I read it many, many, many times because I think when you're a kid, that's how you relate to fiction. You visit it again and again because it's both comforting and it's the way you're forming your sense of self. So Jo March was someone I grew up alongside. For me, it's almost indistinguishable how much of me is me and how much of me belongs to Louisa May Alcott and some other key books of my youth, but that being the biggest one. But I hadn't read it since I was probably 15, and then I picked it up again when I was 30, and I saw it in a completely new light. It was the things I knew given back to me as an adult, and I saw things I'd never seen before. And that's kind of what I wanted to capture about it, were all of these things that I didn't know were there, but that had that same feeling that I loved so much as a girl. And then beyond that, I started learning about Louise May Alcott herself, who I'd never really bothered to learn anything about. And I found her to be completely fascinating and heroic and worthy of exploration. So it was personal in so many ways, and it was transformative in so many ways. And I wanted to bring that kaleidoscope of meaning to this movie.
Two things, Greta, in hearty concurrence, if I may. I have three daughters. One of them told me yesterday she's read this book hundreds of times.
Oh.
I didn't know that. Second point, it seems to me the heroine in this movie, as I see it, is some combination of Louisa May Alcott and yourself. Jo March in the story is your way of telling the world you can make it on your own without Aunt March's money and without a husband necessarily at your side.
Right. Yes, that's true. Well, that's very sweet about your daughter, too. The screenplay in the movie is a conversation between me, Jo March, and Louisa May Alcott. I think in general, I'm interested in how artists make art, male or female, because it necessitates some dividing of self, which is always interesting to me. I open the movie with a quote from Louisa May Alcott. She says, "I've had lots of troubles, so I write jolly tales." You know, they read it and then the movie begins, and whether or not it's something they think about consciously, what I wanted to position them in was this idea of a distance between what happened and how you wrote it. I think that that's something I find inherently emotional, because it's, as a writer and creator, you know, there's life and then there's the art you make from the life that you have.
Can I say, it fascinates me that Greta Gerwig, the ambitious girl dying to escape Sacramento in your movie Lady Bird, has absorbed so much of Concord, Massachusetts in depth. I mean, you've caught New England at its great moment, the American Renaissance of the 1840s, 50s, 60s, Emerson, Thoreau time, the Concord Circle, Hawthorne, Whitman, Margaret Fuller, self-reliance, transcendentalism, American thinking at its best. I wonder, did you discover it, or are those ideas just infiltrated everywhere in young American minds even? Or did you find it?
Well, I mean, I knew of it, but I would say I found it. I mean, I knew the names Emerson and Thoreau and American Transcendentalism. There was a book when I was in high school called, I believe, The Metaphysical Club.
Absolutely.
Which was about, yeah, the story of ideas in America, but I feel like it kind of explored the intellectual underpinnings of that group. Like, it reached just into the distant past. I think that book was the book that made me think about America as having philosophical positions and movements.
It's one of the all-time books.
Yes. I think up until then, I had truly thought of all philosophy as happening in Europe. You know, as a filmmaker, when I started exploring this, you know, because I'm from California, I'm from Sacramento, how much I idealize the kind of intellectual rigor of New England people braving the winters. And I'm, you know, I thought of them as these real, you know, rugged individuals. I think that idealization helped actually in thinking into this world of Concord, Massachusetts. And we were lucky enough to actually shoot in Concord, Massachusetts. I have to say, being in Concord and being in Boston and being in the area around, you know, Concord and Lexington, and does nothing to dissuade you from the belief that it is a magical place because it's all so present. I mean, when you go to Louisa May Alcott's house and you see how close it is, just spitting distance from Ralph Waldo Emerson's house, and then you see where Nathaniel Hawthorne lived, and then you walk just 20 minutes down the road and you can see Walden's Pond, and then the North Bridge where the Revolutionary War started, where Ralph Waldo Emerson's grandfather watched the first shots being fired. you get this sense that this place is deeply engaged with the imaginative act of democracy. And so for them to reform a nation when it needs a better version of itself was not something that was distant past, and it was not something that was unfathomable to them. It was right there. Mm. It would happen right there, and it could happen again. So I think that kind of breadth of imagination about a country is something that infused all of their work, and I think infused Louisa May Alcott's work in ways that she knew deliberately and also ways I think she didn't even totally understand.
This is music to our ears, and it's deeply true. Louisa May Alcott was a close neighbor and a close friend of Emerson. She writes amazingly about a moment when she went over to ask about his sick son, Waldo. He comes to the door. Mm-hmm. She asks, how is he? And he says, child, he is dead. And she registers as a 19-year-old the first experience, profound experience she'd had of loss and sadness and heartbreak. But mm-hmm. also her characters in Little Women are all Emersonians. The whole thought of speak your mind, sing your song, paint your painting, in the case of Amy, or be damned almost. You had to do it.
Yeah. The sort of confrontation of death is all over her work.
Yes.
Most obviously with, I hope I'm not spoiling anyone's good time, but Beth. It was very present for her. You know, she was a Civil War nurse.
Yes.
Her first piece of writing that gained any notoriety was Hospital Sketches, which was about her experience as a Civil War nurse. And it's harrowing. Mm. She holds a man's hand while he's dying. And then she gets so sick as to almost die herself, and she has health problems for the rest of her life because of it. It's both a dreaming of a democracy and a world and a system of thought that's better than what's there, but also that comes out of deep knowledge of what's so difficult about life. It's looking at things square on. I mean, when you read Ralph Waldo Emerson, which is, you know, you really have to spend some time with it because his language is dense. I mean, I think Thoreau is easier to get into, for me anyway. But when you get into Emerson, and it becomes quite emotional what he is trying to do is, how do we look at life without these structures that we've had forever that gild our knowledge? And it's emotional when you think of the fact that he was dealing with his own life and his child.
Yeah.
He was sick. He's not doing this theoretically. He's doing this actually. In any case, being there, being in the space as actors and writers and filmmakers, it's not dusty old fiction in a book. These were real people with real heartbreak and tragedy and joys. And so that just becomes so much easier to grasp when you're in their physical space.
Wow. And Walt Whitman, of course, was an Emerson discovery in some sense, but he was also having that same experience with the Civil War, dead and dying. I can't resist this. Every time I see Chris Cooper in your movie playing Mr. Lawrence, I thought I was looking at Emerson. I saw Emerson, and I want you to make a movie about Emerson and Louisa.
With Chris Cooper. Yeah, that's true. He does look like Emerson in that way. I have to say, he wears a mutton chop very well. You know, you brought up Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman is someone who I didn't directly reference in my movie, but I gave everyone Leaves of Grass to read. The line in Song of Myself of every atom which belongs to me just as surely belongs to you, that kind of fluidness of self and of the sense of we're sort of all each other, that definitely went into this melding of Louisa May Alcott and Joan Marsh, but also the breaking apart. But it's like that we are this multiplicity of selves. It felt like a poetic idea that he was engaged with and the Transcendentalists were engaged with. So it felt, as a writer, that I wasn't doing something meta just to be cute, but I could do it in a way that felt more grounded in something they were thinking about.
Greta, there's something very contemporary in all this, known in the bookstores as autofiction. Ben Lerner, Sheila Hedy, Rachel Cusk, lots of others writing novels about their inner histories, writing as a mode of self-actualization or something. I associate the movie with them, but you're also very 19th century too. Not only Louisa May, but
Yeah.
George Eliot, Middlemarch, the Bronte sisters. You have a nice shout out to the Brontes. I wonder what fired that. Louisa didn't write that. But also, for me, a link to Henry James, Portrait of a Lady. Speak of those connections in your own reading, backward and forward.
I'm a big fan of Sheila Hetty and Rachel Kaskin. I love the Outline trilogy, and I think they're doing something with fiction that kind of blends something that feels like autobiography, but is also constructed, that I think is fascinating. And, you know, how does one write the character of Sheila Hetty, if you're Sheila Hetty, and how is that different from real Sheila Hetty? And she's, you know, right. It's a novel. She's been very clear about that. And anyway, I think those questions are deeply fascinating. And I mean, even Carl Ove Nosgaard, my struggle books are also engaged with this.
Interesting.
I mean, it's not just female authors, it's male authors. There's something in the water right now. I can't help but be influenced by that as a person who loves reading and as a person who's a writer and a maker of things. I know this. But I will say, I did want to steep it in the 19th century, and it feels modern, but I wanted it to feel modern out of its adherence to its classicism. Like, I didn't want to change the language so drastically. A lot of the lines from Louise's book are so famous, and women know them so well, that I didn't want to mess with lines like "Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents." The way I decided I wanted to do it was I wanted them to be said very, very fast and full of life, like the first teenage girl to ever say those words. Mm. And that helped to just shake something loose in the language that felt alive and it felt modern. Thank you for noticing my call out to George Eliot. I put that in. It's a scene in the movie where Jo is reading to Beth on the beach. She's reading from The Mill on the Floss. I love that book. I love George Eliot. The passages, "We could never have loved the earth so well had we had no childhood in it," which I just think is such a marvelous sentiment. And it's about how the things that are familiar breed love, not contempt. It's beautiful. That came out of when I went to Louisa's house. They have just a sampling of her library, and she loved George Eliot. She read George Eliot. She also loved the Bronte sisters. All of her sisters loved the Bronte sisters, which is why I put that in. Yes, they were incredibly well read. I mean, all over the text of Little Women is literary references. I mean, these were women who defined themselves by the things they read. And they were very aware of the Bronte sisters as being considered geniuses. Mm. I'm fascinated by what do you do with women geniuses in the 19th century? And one way I wanted to reconfigure these girls was to take their artistic pursuits incredibly seriously and examine what does the 19th century have for someone like that? And the lines that feel modern, like Amy saying, "I want to be great or nothing," that's from the book. It's not something that I made up. And I thought, oh my God, she wants to be great or nothing? And she's painting in Europe at the moment when Manet and Cézanne started showing. How fascinating. That's a fascinating moment to be a female artist. And what is your position in this?
I have to credit you with your own words, not Louise's, in that speech that Jo gives toward the end. She says, women, they have minds and they have souls as well as just hearts. They've got ambition and they've got talent as well as just beauty. She said, I'm so sick of people saying that love is all a woman is fit for. I'm so sick of it. That's perfect. It's Louisa May, it's Jo, it's my kids, it's you. It's so many people we know today, if I may.
I just have to be clear that that whole speech is actually from another novel of Louise's. I took most of it from that. The way I treated the script was I used a lot of Louise's words, even if they weren't words directly from the book. But I took it from another book, but then I added the line, "But I'm so lonely," because I didn't want Jo to be so certain all of the time. And I think that there's a way that we can ascribe her with certainty that never doubts itself, like Jo, headstrong, always knew what she wanted. And I don't think that that's true. And I think there's evidence in the text that that's not true. And insofar that Jo is an avatar for Louisa, I think that there is something lonely there, something that had to give one thing up to get another thing. And I thought that that was worth putting in. And the book is not narrated by Jo. The book is narrated by the narrator, presumably Louisa, who has her own voice, and sometimes she'll pop through. And she has this very beautiful section of writing that I never figured out how to put in the film, but I loved and I wanted the spirit of it in, which talks about women becoming spinsters, women never getting married. To me, unlike Jo March, because Jo March, you know, gets married and has children and stopped writing, that Louisa never got married, never had children, and no one really knows what that was. She's crossed out whole sections of her diary. There are things she didn't want us to know. Mm. But in this passage, she says, be kind to the somber sisters. She's, you know, referring to spinsters, and she says, you don't know what passions have beat under their dark gowns. And you're like, oh my God, she's talking about herself. You don't know what her life was. You don't know what she wanted or she got or she gave up. And then she says to the men, she says, what chivalry is worth having that is not kind to these women? It's just the most beautiful thing. And I just really felt Louisa speak through the pages, and I felt this yearning. And I thought, okay, I'm going to take this piece of text and then I'm going to say, but I'm so lonely at the end. And I think that that's earned. I think it's okay to do. I was very careful. I never wanted to put anything in the movie that didn't feel like I knew where my justification for it was, because I wanted to be respectful as much as I could be of who she was. Given that I can't talk to her, I wanted to try to piece together what I think she would have been okay with.
Coming up, story time, and the particular fascination with writers becoming writers. This is Open Source. A last word here from Greta Gerwig. I told her she seemed to be unfolding an observation from one of my daughters that Louisa May Alcott is so good at the weather of sisterhood, flare-ups, jokes, alliances, shifting balances. So I asked her about the sisters that might have shaped something of Greta Gerwig.
I think the kind of unit of sisters, my understanding of that actually comes more from, I have a group of very tight girlfriends. There's six of us all together. We met when we were 18 at Barnard College in New York, and they are very, very close to me, and we've gone through, we're like family by choice, but we've gone through wonderful times. We've gone through hard times. We've gone through times when people aren't speaking to each other. We've come back again. I mean, they're true, deep relationships.
I believe it.
Also within them, there are very tight sister groups. I would say four of the six have sisters who are within 18 months of each other. So like they'd have a sister who is like, you know, really close. Those female friends and all their sisters, my love of them and also my understanding of those complexities went into my forming the March Sisters.
Maria Tartar is an interpreter of stories. She's our authority on children's literature, fairy tales, myths the world over. She's the author of Enchanted Hunters, The Power of Stories in Childhood, and she teaches literature at Harvard. Maria Tartar told us this week she's been obsessed with Little Women from way back.
I read it as a child, and of course I loved Jo. I didn't identify with her, but I loved watching everything that she did. She was a misfit. She belonged, and yet she didn't belong. And that was my first encounter. And then my daughter fell in love with the book. And I'll never forget the way that we used to, every holiday season, we would say, Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, grumbled Joe, lying on the rug. And, you know, to this day, I don't know exactly what was packaged in that sentence for us, why it became so powerful for us.
That's what we got to figure out. And I'm thinking, it's a touchstone of consciousness, of ambition, of affirmation. And suddenly, this movie lets us all in on the party. How long has this been going on, that girls pass it on, you read it, who you?
What you say is extraordinary, because it reminds me that Little Women is not on the college curriculum. You take a course in an English department, no one is reading Little Women.
You study and write about, teach Ur stories, the basic stories. Where do you put Little Women on the giant map of kinds of stories?
Well, first I have to say, guilty as charged to my own accusation, because I teach a course on children's literature, and I have not included Little Women on the syllabus,
uh-oh,
even though it the syllabus changes from year to year. As far as the map, I think, as I was watching the film, I realized that Alice in Wonderland, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, came out in 1865. So,
fascinating. Almost coincidental.
Yes. And what is Alice about? A girl, in this case, a young girl, trying to find herself, disoriented in this world of nonsense. It may be Wonderland, but it's also deeply terrifying. And there are all kinds of monsters and predators in that realm. Mm. So she has to find herself. She has to figure out how to speak properly. She learns a lot about language in the course of her adventures. Mm. And I think that's a wonderful analogy with storytelling in Little Women. That is, finding your voice as a child, becoming an adult, but also finding your voice as a storyteller.
Mm. As a playwright in their little home theatricals, too. I mean, that...
Isn't that extraordinary? Which is, you know, these theatricals, they're all about staging the self and performance, and understanding that through performance, you begin to figure out who you are. You shape your own identity. Mm. Because after all, you know, life is one big performance also. So this is a way of working through the questions of identity in a symbolic way, in a safe space. Mm. This is one of the things I love about stories in general, about fairy tales, for example. You know, once upon a time, you are in the safe space of story, and you know, you're there with the great what-ifs, the counterfactuals. Mm. You could do anything that you want. You can test all kinds of possibilities. And you can encounter all sorts of perils and still come out with a happily ever after at the
end. So what is she touching here with gloves on, with fictional gloves on, the hot stoves of her own heart?
The narrator's voice, which may be slightly different from Louisa May Alcott, but the narrator is totally uninhibited, as are the girls
right.
In many ways. They're expressive. They tell us what is on their mind. We don't need a Henry James type of narrator to tell us about what is going on inside the minds, because the girls say what they feel.
But spell it out. What is she touching on? For example, about her father. He was a famous sort of flop in life, an idealistic, saintly person. If you don't believe it, just ask him. He'll tell you the nobility of his thoughts. But he was a failure, and she writes him out of the book. There's a gesture right there.
Yes, right.
No daddy on this scene.
No, I'm reminded of how Joe tells us that families are so beautiful. There's, you know, something so beautiful about a family, but also something so terrible. And families are dysfunctional. And there can be wonderful times. There can be scenes of plenitude, as at the end of the film when we see the family assembled on the green. But there can be rough and tumble, actually more than rough and tumble. There can be real fist fights. And the burning of the manuscript. I mean, can you imagine anything more terrible than that? Little Women gives us the family with all its complications and with the dark side of living together in one little house in a place that is not hospitable, in a climate that is not hospitable.
Making do, no money.
Making do, being trapped in some ways. So what do you do? How do you maintain civility? So I love the fact that there's a civil war going on, but then also all the domestic conflicts and turmoils in the March House that we see.
I like that. Everybody in the book, all the sisters, surely, have a kind of rendezvous with genius or with talent anyway, and they have this good Emersonian compulsion to make something of it, girl. And what is that navigation, and what is she telling us, even about, it's a problem for 19th century women, what about 21st century women, and men too, if I may say?
The novel's obsession with genius is extraordinary, but what Louisa May Alcott tells us is that genius requires work, It requires sweat. It means practice, 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 whether it's the piano or painting or writing. And that whole fetishizing of labor, I think, is something distinctive about the novel.
How do you mean fetishizing labor?
Of labor. That is a drumbeat in the novel about the importance of putting your shoulder to the wheel and your nose to the grindstone and getting it done. That is, there is virtue in hard work. On the other hand, there's also the romance of writing and of art. And we see that, the film brings that out beautifully, is that moment when Joe spreads out the manuscript. It's an incandescent moment near the end of the film. She spreads out the pages, and what? There's candlelight in the room. There's this soft glow, and she is all alone with her manuscript, and it's almost as if, you know, the book has become her lover in a strange way. So there is, you know, that doesn't look like hard work. But I think Alcott tells us throughout the book, yes, it really is. And there are these moments, these transcendent moments where the book is in print and it feels like it's easy, that labor. Actually, you know, labor, if you think about it, the whole question of the relationship between creativity and procreation, and the book becomes a kind of baby. So maybe you don't have to get married and have children after all.
And we see the binding and the stitching.
You know, the gold, the embossed gold. It's a thing of beauty.
And when Greta Gerwig talks about it, we're all drawn into telling a story with this incredible technology still evolving of film. Is it the same immersion in the tricks of story making?
No, it's fascinating to me that film has in many ways become our new folklore. That is, it's something that we talk about all the time. I'm astonished by how often when I'm eavesdropping on conversations, and I do a lot of that, I'm afraid, people are always talking about films. And the other day, I heard a man going on and on about how he was a film buff. He had seen every film made in the 20s and 30s and so on. So it is
He's working on a screenplay, too, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Yes, absolutely. So it's our collective obsession. And so we are deeply invested in the stories that are told, not just in our own stories, but the stories that are out there on the screen, on our screens, and in our books.
Put Greta and Louisa and Little Women, all of it, all of us fans too, in the context of women's fiction in the 20th, especially the 19th century, as Greta loves to do, especially George Eliot, the Bronte sisters, Jane Austen in the deep past too, but what is she adding to the tradition?
I think Louisa May Alcott is not so much adding as subtracting. She is telling us the compulsory marriage is no longer compulsory. That is, there are different aspirations for each of the girls in that novel. And the happily ever after can be a whole range of different things. It can be starting a school for boys. I mean, it's true, of course, Joe marries as a concession to the publisher. But we sort of know that there's more to Joe than that, that she is a writer. She's also a teacher. She has a philanthropic streak. She's deeply social. She's not just up in that room spreading out the sheets of the manuscript, but she's out there in the world doing good. In the book, when the girls on Christmas morning go to the Hummels and share their breakfast, it's an extraordinary moment of self-restraint and a discovery, though, that this simple act of generosity can transform you. And then what happens? There's an immediate payoff and reward, which is something very satisfying for a young person. That is, you can have your cake or not have your cake and eat it too in some sort of crazy way.
Why were these children's stories emerging in a way in the commercial market in the mid-19th century?
I think we could go back to John Locke and Rousseau. Because they are telling us suddenly that there's something deeply interesting about the mind of the child. That is, no one was interested in that before.
Bronson Alcott knew it deeply.
Yes, and I think that is something that Louisa May Alcott learned from him, that there is value in understanding what goes on in the mind of the child. Suddenly, philosophers are interested in it. If you then make the link to the question of imagination, which, of course, Lewis Carroll did so powerfully, and Louisa May Alcott also, because each of the March sisters has some sort of connection to art, art, imagination, and how it enlivens and enriches our lives. That is, there's something else there. So it is the 19th century that is linking the child with the world of imagination. Alice and Peter, where do they go? To Wonderland and to Neverland, which is an island of the child's mind. Barry even gives us a description of it and tells us that it is a map of the child's mind.
We have to credit Bronson Alcott here for some of this, but what do they do? What do they intend to do, imagine doing with this insight about building on the imagination of children?
19th century discovered the portal fantasy, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, that children escape somehow. They escape dull, drab reality. And where do they go? Into a place where anything can happen. And this is the place of imagination, of make-believe. Make-believe, which is, of course, connected so deeply with the making of beliefs. So this is a place of play. It's a kind of paradise, but it's also fraught. What does Louisa May Alcott do? She doesn't give us a portal fantasy. She tells us that home can be the place where you cultivate the imagination. You don't have to run away the way that Huck Finn does. You can stay in one place, which is, of course, something that girls were pretty much required to do, and you can still escape. You can still find outlets for your imagination. It may simply be on a homemade stage, or it may be in front of an easel, or it may be at your desk, but you can still go to elsewhere, a place where you discover the delights of imagination, but you also learn things about yourself, and you begin to figure out who you are and who you want to be, navigating your way into the future.
How do we revise our definition of genius in this context? Is it in every child, or is it a sort of distant star that some of these people are striving too hard for, or something?
Oh, I hope it is not a distant star. That is, to my mind, let me put it this way, every child is a genius. And sometimes adults succeed in killing off that genius. I think here of a friend of mine who loved to draw as a child and paint, and his mother decided that she did not want him to fool around with all of that silliness. He eventually went into venture capital, quit his job, and became what? A painter, and a genius painter. So I think that spark is, it lives in all of us. And the hope is that the child will encounter the right adults, the adults who will nurture that, the spark that becomes a flame, and feed it and fuel it and turn you into an adult genius.
It's reason enough to go to Alcott's house, the abandon with which kids covered the walls with drawings, doors, window frames. It's all done expressively, interestingly, individually. And Mom didn't say, well, you clean up that window.
You know, and I think that's exactly what Louisa May Alcott was in touch with, and that's why we love her. She gave us this great gift, the message that everyone has something in them that must be cultivated, something of value. And you may not become what the world acknowledges as a genius, but you will find your own greatness in one way or another.
Thank you, Maria Tatar, and Jan Turnquist at Concord's Orchard House, and Greta Gerwig, onward, as Emerson would say. Come back to this part of the world and we'll canoe on the Concord River together.
Sounds wonderful.
Thank you so much for the work and for this conversation.
Thank you. I really enjoyed speaking to you. I miss Massachusetts.
You're welcome anytime.
Okay. Good.
Visit our website at radioopensource.org and see pictures of our field trip to the Olcott Orchard House in Concord. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our real Joe March. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.